First steps as mayor will be to publicly convene all the banks who work in the city and to sit them around the negotiating table in order to stop the evictions and to say that we need the empty homes that they have in the city as social affordable rental housing for the families who need it.
Para ponerlas en alquiler social para las familias que lo necesitan.
Ada Colau, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations as the first woman mayor of Barcelona, Spain. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Barcelona mayor-elect Ada Colau. We will be posting the original interview in Spanish on our website, democracynow.org. Just click on Español. And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Chuck Skurich, Julie Crosby, Clara Ibarra, Igor Moreno, Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dennis Moynihan, Aaron Maté, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 a.m. Now we are going to go to Positively Revolting with guest host Lisa Loving. I need to tell you that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater presenting an evening with Jonathan Richman, Tuesday the 9th. Doors open at 7, show at 8. And tickets information for Jonathan Richman are available at aladdin-theater.com.
Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. It don't matter anyhow. It ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe, if you don't know by now. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on. Don't think twice, it's all.
It's 8 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland. We are Positively Revolting. I'm Lisa Loving, sitting in for Ani and Lynn. And today, the serial forced displacement of poor people and people of color from urban areas. Is gentrification a public health crisis? How do we turn this around? We ask ourselves that all the time. Our guest is community advocate Kat Gogenauer. Kat, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
I think this is a great opportunity to talk to someone who has a deep knowledge of the policy around all the different policies affecting gentrification. And there are many, from healthcare to housing and the environment. And Kat is a community advocate who has worked with the Urban League of Portland, Self Enhancement Incorporated, all kinds of community of color organizations, had a piece of the PALF's People's Plan. I'd like to talk about that a little when we have a minute, because the People's Plan seems very important. I don't hear enough people talking about it. And again, Kat is about the policy, listeners. So I love the policy part, because it just sounds so boring and dull, but it's really where it happens. Why the policy, Kat? Why is policy a pressure point for you as an activist, an advocate?
Well, gentrification is caused by a confluence of policy decisions, both historical and contemporarily, that are impacting people's daily lives. And so when we look at economic development policy or housing policy with regard to redlining, or how the federal government gave out loans to people to do homeownership during the 1950s, we can see those effects today. Current policies around urban renewal are also very impactful. They predominantly put resources into sticks and bricks, as they say. They do investments in the built environment, not necessarily investing in people who live in those areas. And so the reason I like to look at policy is we can really understand where there are some opportunities to change those, or even just to lift up parts that have been a part of our policy fabric that maybe have not been brought forward. Things like the affirmatively furthering fair housing duty with regard to the Fair Housing Act. We have actually had a lot of laws that have a wonderful spirit, but maybe have not been enacted in the way they were anticipated.
I don't know if we could ever talk about this issue enough. Listeners, is gentrification impacting you, and is it literally making you sick? And how do we get our arms around actually making the difference here? That's the part that gets me, is what should we be doing? So 503-231-8187. It's interesting to me that you had talked about the system. I mean, again, I go back to the system. Mm-hmm. Last week, we had an amazing activist around Stop Demolishing Portland, and she knows chapter and verse about the individual specific actors who are developers in our region, and specifically what they're doing and what the concerns might be about how they're violating the law or the spirit of the law, even in terms of things like when people get their yard tested to see, you know, before it's more developed, you know, to see what's in the soil or what happens to the water runoff, things that we don't even realize are the law that people are supposed to do, and people are, and these developers are not really doing it, but who cares is the question, and citizens are trying to make a difference. But you had said, what interests me here is that you're talking about how the system basically invests in sticks and bricks, but not people. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? I mean, how, we always hear these things from government, especially elected officials, that we can't give preferential hiring to people of color because that would be affirmative action and that's against the law. But we do have laws that say that if someone is a veteran, they are automatically guaranteed a job interview in certain situations. But it's like, so in certain situations, we have laws that nurture people, but for the most part, not. I mean, where does that
it's
come
very
from?
Complicated. I think you bring up a really good point. You know, just to speak a little bit about the public health framing of gentrification, I think that's really important. Unnatural Causes came out in 2008.
It's a film, a documentary film.
It is a documentary film. It has several different parts in it that really look at social determinants of health. So how the economy or just the way social or society is structured, if there's integration or segregation, and then systems of power or political representation, how those all come together to create the environment. So that's one of the things I really like about public health. We think and talk differently about environment. You know, a lot of policy focuses on the built environment, what urban planners call the built environment. That's buildings. Gets to the sticks and bricks part. And then there's the natural environment, obviously, we know, you know, green spaces and all of that. But then there's the socially constructed environment. And that is the part around these laws. And so kind of what I think you're getting at is the arbitrary nature that some of these policies are enforced or taken up. And, you know, I think it's great. I think a lot of people definitely need special protections. That's why the federal government calls us protected classes. Mm-hmm. You know, women, families, veterans, people of color, national origin, multitudes of things. These are, you know, folks who we recognize in the through the law have been excluded, have been socially excluded, who might be suffering from different forms of trauma due to their isolation from social systems, from community, and who need
people
extra
getting moved
support.
Out to East County. But SEI isn't in, maybe there is an SEI in East County now, but people who get pushed out to the East County and then they don't have access to the services that they had before, even their churches, even basic rooted community aspects.
Right. And so, you know, our Black institutions are definitely trying to move with our populations at this point. But, you know, we had a very well-established Black community in Portland due to a multitude of factors, you know, specifically restrictive covenants and redlining. You know, these are not necessarily seen as positive because they did essentially ghettoize, you know, people. We were segregated in North Northeast Portland. However, in the face of that, people formed a thriving and vibrant community. You know, we were interconnected. People were tied to one another in that we provided mutual support, and our institutions grew up around that. You know, so we were able to serve our primary constituency because we were all proximal. We were all located near one another. That's one of the most insidious things, really, about gentrification and this forced displacement, right? We talk about community on the move. That presupposes choice. And a lot of people, and you know, when we talked about talk about forced displacement, we're talking about lack of choice, right? People are being moved out because rents are too high. They can't find jobs. Their Section 8 vouchers are only allocated in certain parts of the city. So they have to move where those opportunities are. And so our institutions are busily trying to make sure we are still reaching our constituency. But it's definitely difficult when there are miles and miles.
People are scattered out. Mm-hmm. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Lisa. I'm sitting in for Ani and Lynn. Our guest is community advocate Kat Gogenauer. And we're asking, is gentrification literally making you sick? And how can we get our arms around this issue to change this up, change up what's happening? We just mentioned Community on the Move. Community on the Move is actually an Oregon Historical Society exhibit right now. Strongly encourage people to go check that out. And it's called Community on the Move because the African-American community has been forced and displaced so many times, mm-hmm. not just to East County, repeatedly. Really strongly recommend that you go check that out. And there are a few other things we talked about, but let's go to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We have Leah on the phone. What's going on, Leah?
Well, you asked if we'd been we're in gentrification and displacement, and I am. I live out here in East County. I am a Caucasian, but I, in my early years, lived over on Michigan, where my daughter was born, and I raised her over there for a few years, and I loved it in that community. It was a very mixed community. It was a wonderful community. I knew my neighbors. I'm living out here, East Portland. I'm on the East Portland Action Plan. I'm also on the Housing Subcommittee, great. And I'm being displaced. I'm on Social Security. Very limited income. I get about $800 a month, and everything has to come out of that. And I got my rent raised $50 this year. Came straight through from Section 8. No mitigation at all. So my issue here is, and I'm also working with the Portland Renters Assembly Group to address these issues.
The Portland Renters Assembly is very dynamic.
Yes, and I was part of the group that addressed the city council. I've been in the commissioners several times on housing issues. But in my own committee, on the subcommittee, I'm so frustrated because it's like business as usual. Nobody's talking about the laws and the regulations and the policies that keep people from being displaced. So I'm going to be displaced here, and I'm trying to find a place. One of the things I ran into was I have a friend we were looking for a house together, and we got approved for a $200,000 loan through both for the VA and the FHA, and we found several lovely little places that were just perfect for us, and we could afford them, and we got bidded out. Mm. So even though we had money to buy, we were not allowed to buy because if they had any repairs, they would kick us over into a different market, adjustable rate mortgage. It would cost us more money. We also had to do a higher loan than we wanted. And then the houses we bid it on, we put earnest money down and everything. And some of us, we were the first ones there. And we got bid it out. It's a bidding war. And these renters, I'm so angry because what I'm finding is that EPEP is not paying. It's like business as usual. They have this 5-year plan, and I'm going, you know what? You've been doing this for 5 years. In 5 years, it'll be the same. Nothing's going to change unless you put teeth in these laws.
EPAP, that's the East Portland Action Plan. Leah, thanks a lot for calling. Leah put a whole lot on the table there.
Yes, she spoke about the crisis.
It is a crisis. And it the thing that gets me, too, is there was a really great article in Investigates West, which is a new media outlet here in Portland that is Investigative Reporters. It's a nonprofit organization. Our amazing friends over there did a great story about this issue of how people are being bid out of the houses, even when they have the money. And it's kind of like it's become an investment thing. Mm-hmm. And people in other parts of the country, they think, my 401k is tanking. I want to retire. I can't, the stock market's not working. It's all about the property. So they join these in organizations and businesses where they can pool their money and bid on property, and then they have pieces of property. So in other words, It's almost like people just like Leah, who have a little bit of money on the East Coast, they want to invest, and so they put her out of a home. You know, that's the way it looks like to me, right. Those things.
I agree 100%. And so, that, you know, that's the thing. Housing is a human right. Article 25 of the Declaration of Human Rights speaks about that. So then it's very interesting and complicated when it also becomes an investment strategy. And, you know, no one can kind of fault people, because the return on investment at this point of purchasing these homes, especially if you're going to do an Airbnb or, you know, not use it as your primary dwelling and, you know, have an unregulated rental market. We don't have rent control here in the state of Oregon, nor do we have inclusionary zoning, which is another, you know, policy mechanism whereby a percentage of all new development would have to be made affordable. It is a very significant problem. The displacement from East County is already happening. We've heard this specifically from folks at EPAP, that, you know, their neighborhoods are becoming more desirable because the demand is increasing, right? As people are pushed out and replaced by, you know, higher income people in the inner city core, and people are moved to the margins, those people are now facing another wave of displacement because, you know, middle income people can't afford to live in the city.
In my former job, I had this incredibly intelligent coworker named Donovan Smith, and we've been talking about this issue, gentrification 3.0. Once you're displaced mm-hmm. from East County, where do you can you live on the top of Mount Hood, because rent's cheap on the very top of Mount Hood? And this is KBOO Portland. We are positively revolting. We have some more callers. Let's go back to the phone line. George is on the phone. What's going on, George?
Good morning. Well, I was listening to everything you've been saying, and I thought, oh, my God. I just listened a few minutes before to an interview on Democracy Now! With Ada Colau, the new mayor of Barcelona. And she was talking about virtually everything you've been talking about, only in Spain, and in particular in Barcelona. And she's the new mayor who, a few months ago, I believe it was, in a meeting, a policy meeting, it may have been in the Spanish Parliament, or it may have been in Barcelona, but I think it was in the Parliament, confronted a banker, and she pointed to him and spoke to all the assembled other people and said, "This man is a criminal." And she talked about the drastic effects on the poor of foreclosure of mortgages, mm-hmm. and it's possibly a little worse in Barcelona than in Portland, but if we allow the system of capital investment for profit to continue and we don't develop a massive indignados movement like they did in Barcelona, which is very similar to our Occupy movement, we are going to find ourselves, all of us, sick in multiple ways, not only in terms of our physical health, but in terms of our entire community power. We will lose our interhumanity to capital, which continues to squeeze more and more mercilessly and relentlessly day by day to force out the poor of all ethnicities, and especially the weakest of the poor, the women, mm-hmm. and the women who are living, trying to raise their children, and the families.
George, let me ask you this. So if you're listening to KBOO, if you were listening to Democracy Now!, that tells me you're hardcore saying, do you do something in the community? Do you have an activist place where you plug in, or do you feel as though there's sort of a fault line where you would recommend that people pitch into that place to try to tip the equation?
Well, I'm going to be 81 on the 4th of July, and I do a few things in talking with people, and I try to make available, I rent the lower part of my home at a low rent, and right now that's $650, and that includes utilities. But this is tiny, and one of the things I would like very much to do is be part of the marches where they say Black Lives Matter, because the poorest of the poor often are African Americans and Hispanic people, mm-hmm. and include also many people who are called white or Caucasian. Mm-hmm. We need to all get together, and we need to start demonstrating and saying, well, what Ada Colau said in the interview was, you have to be ready. I don't know if this is exact words, but she said, you have to be ready when things get this bad to commit civil disobedience, and it has to be massive numbers. And I want to do that. I was thinking the other day about Dr. Spock back in 1960s. You know, the famous Benjamin Spock, a baby doctor who in his 80s was out marching against the Vietnam War. And I think we're all going to have to do this. And I don't do a whole lot, but one of the things I did the other day, someone said, the 4th of July, what a terrific birthday. And I said, well, thanks, but you know, now one of the birthdays I more and more want to celebrate is the 5th of May, the birthday of Karl Marx, but also of all the great women organizers like Ada Colau, and the new mayor of Barcelona, I believe also a radical, and a woman too, perhaps, in Madrid, new mayor.
Awesome, George. Here, I got to jump in because we have a few more callers.
Hey, great.
George, I'm going to think of you on the 4th of July.
Hey, well, think of all of these great women and the great organizers in Latin America, all of them, and all over the world, in Spain, in Europe, and the Middle East, who are saying, enough is enough.
Awesome, George.
I just want to speak quickly to something George touched upon that's very important. It's the political will. Right, the ability for electeds, people in power, to really take up the issues of the most burdened and marginalized and prioritize those and really hold people accountable and say, you know, we're doing this for those who are the least among us. And George, I'm very inspired by also you providing housing at a sub market level. I think that is a wonderful example, and I know of quite a few people who are doing this as their own way of dealing with gentrification.
It's true. And George also said he was talking about who's most affected by some of these issues, and I did have to come out and say that the 2015 homeless count report is called the point in time count of homeless, right? The 2015 point in time count of homeless in Portland showed that there's a rise in homeless African Americans in our region, and that's unusual, actually.
Yeah. It's up by 50%
which
in
is
2 years.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. That's mind-boggling,
right?
Because traditionally, specifically, I can't speak to other communities, but this is a community that I've reported on for many years. Traditionally, African American people don't let members of their family not have a place to live. So there's more people who will invite someone to sleep on the floor or on the couch. Traditionally.
They call that doubling up.
Up. And so when you're saying that the number of African American people on the street is up by 50%, that is definitely, you're just saying the word gentrification. People are getting pushed out of their houses.
Well, in conjunction with the State of Housing report, also out of Portland Housing Bureau last month, that shows that Native Americans and African Americans, because of our median income, it's about $27,000 for African Americans, $22,000 for Native Americans, cannot afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the 24 neighborhoods outlined in the city of Portland. And so if you think about that, you know, we generally are multi-generational families, but you need space. You need space enough to do that. If you can't afford a two-bedroom or anything higher, then we're talking about one bedrooms and studios, and how many people can you have in there, really, especially around renting law, right? You can't have over occupancy, or you're in violation and you can face an eviction for having too many people in your space. So, you know, the problem is economic. I mean, you cannot have people existing on half of the median income and assume that they will be able to do enough for themselves. And then, you know, then it's also a housing issue. How do we find properties that aren't like the one that just came up in our neighborhood on Alberta and Vancouver? The one bedroom start at $1,700. You know, there is no way someone earning $27,000 a year can afford that and have money left over for anything else, right?
This, you know, of all the issues that we look at, this one, it you know, the roads are falling apart. Yes, they are. The schools are falling apart big time in Oregon. There's something about the housing. I mean, isn't it somebody's job to make sure the system works for people? I guess not. And we were talking about how Tracy Manning, the perfectly nice person who runs the Portland Housing Bureau, she's leaving that job, basically. And what she said about it was she's reaching for a more balanced life or something like that, and which is not the usual excuse that you see for people leaving a job like that. But I don't know. I was talking a little bit earlier about my coworker, Donovan. Donovan had been doing a little bit of research in other areas with gentrification, such as Minneapolis, Minnesota. In some of these other areas, the city officials are going, yep, people are going to have to move. Bye. They don't. They're mm-hmm. literally not doing any amelioration or pretending to, which is interesting to me. So why right. do we pretend to care, but we don't really? I'm not sure that we're doing. I don't know what we could do, because the housing deficit for the next projected 20 years is like the city is saying we need 150,000 new housing units to handle right. the people that are supposed to move here, which this is a climate refugee kind of a place. Just right. wait till the earthquake hits. But I mean, anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to the phone lines. Frances is on the phone. Frances, what's going on with you?
Hi, I appreciate the discussion this morning. And when you were just speaking about people being on the street, it's with the rules and the laws the way they are now about people with criminal records living in housing, a lot of families who would normally greet someone coming out of prison to allow them to stay in their home mm-hmm. can't. They have to turn them away mm-hmm. because or else they'll lose their housing also.
Yes.
And that is one of the reasons there's more people on the street. I think at this point, when you look at the history, which I appreciate you're discussing, and the policies that have been in place for years that caused gentrification, I think it's time to start talking about restorative justice.
Yes.
I can remember a realtor publicly stating proudly that every time there was a drive-by, he made money. Mm-hmm. And there were some very nefarious actions that took place, say, within the last 20 years when I was living in Northeast Portland. One of some of the same area in North and Northeast Portland that was targeted by HGD to have inspectors, allegedly at the request of neighborhood associations, to go around and look for building mm-hmm. code violations mm-hmm. to slap a lien on somebody's property, which may be easier for some to deal with than others. And that same area, also exactly the same area, if you overlaid a map, the unconstitutional drug-free zones were in the very same area
yes.
in which people who were arrested for drugs were excluded from their own neighborhood and could be charged with criminal trespassing if they came back into yeah. that neighborhood. And Grandma's house could get a chronic nuisance ordinance because she allowed a son or a grandchild to live in her home who had been charged could have been elsewhere.
It's true. When you start thinking of the laundry list all of all the stuff. And Frances, I'm also remembering, you brought this thing up about the inspectors that looked for building code violations. I remember the Portland Tribune doing a big story about a City of Portland housing inspector who was married to a real estate agent mm-hmm. and they were found guilty of fraud, and mm-hmm. because he was dinging the buildings and then she was turning around and fast selling them right. and they even kind of intimidated the homeowners because they were targeting elderly homeowners, specifically elderly homeowners. Mm-hmm. And I was just on the phone with an elderly woman a few weeks ago, super interesting lady named Audrey, and she wanted to tell her life story. And she was talking about how many elderly white and African-American, specifically African-American white elderly women who lived right on her block. They didn't have family. They looked out for each other, but they were all constantly targeted by people trying to short sell their homes, even right. now.
Even
and
now.
She's mm-hmm. 80. She's almost 90. She's talking about another couple of women who have dementia, but they're still able to live in their homes. And she's wondering if someone could literally rip them off for their property right. because they don't know what's going on.
Well, Frances. It's very predatory.
Yeah.
And Frances, you brought up so many wonderful points. And there's a wonderful article out that talks about evictions and convictions causing the same kind of trauma in populations. Obviously, convictions predominantly impact men, as we think about it today,
more
African-American
women.
Men. Yeah. But evictions are something that plagues women, single mothers, you know, for a multitude of reasons, but the trauma people experience is very similar. And that's, you know, also why I prefer a public health framing about this. Mindy Fuller Love speaks about root shock and this traumatic experience that happens when you become disconnected from your community, when you no longer belong, when you're forced into a new neighborhood where people don't, you know, we talk about seeing each other, right? People don't see you. There's intentional civil inattention, and they neglect, you know, it's a more neglectful kind of environment. But what Francis speaks to me is the dearth of oversight. You know, a lot of these predatory actions continue because we're not looking at them. And then when we are and we're seeing that there is fraud, we're not looking to see if there's a system or a pattern. And, you know, really, if we look at these not as isolated incidences, but more as business as usual, the structure, we could see there are a lot of opportunities. I did just want to speak to Portland Housing Bureau. You know, city is what it is, and Portland Housing Bureau has done the North Northeast housing strategy in response to kind of the hubbub that happened around the Trader Joe's property on MLK in Alberta. And it was a decision to go out into the community and start to do some focus groups and really find out what the needs of the community were or are. $20 million was allocated around this.
And this happened late last year, like for the last 6 months of last year.
Right. And so this money has been made available. At this point, they're trying to figure out how to increase first-time homeownership for low-income people, how to increase affordable housing rentals. We've also pressed for land bank dollars so that low-income and people of color are able to purchase some properties and do our own community development and also reap the equity from that. And then they've also, we're in the process of working through this preference policy, a way to target as well, but in a positive way, folks who have been displaced through no cause of their own, really, and giving them an opportunity to come back. So
that the right of return to Northeast Portland.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, there are incremental steps happening. I really stress looking at the things that are working and saying, if this is one action by one city bureau, how do we systematize this and get all the city bureaus working towards the same goal? How do we integrate these progressive type policies into all the business as usual and make sure we're doing a concerted strategy to deal with a lot of these issues?
And we do have a caller, and we can go to the caller in a second. 503-231-8187. We're looking at this issue of gentrification. Is gentrification literally making us sick? Is it a public health issue? And what do we do to really address it instead of just watching it wash down the river for another 50 years? And let's go to the caller. Thomas is on the phone. What's going on, Thomas?
Yeah, hi. I'm really glad you're talking about this topic. I live in Vancouver, and, what I see going on in Portland is just total madness. I've lived here since the early 1980s, and the city used to be much more pleasant, you know, and I avoid it now. Not that that's not going to happen here in Vancouver, but it's slowed down quite a bit. And the system you keep talking about, it seems to me, is totally designed to serve the bankers, the builders, and the realtors. And that's why it's so extremely difficult to make any headway. So I have one question. Is there any place in the you see as an example of how you would like to see things work? Is there some place where the reforms are working to benefit the people? And I can take my answer off of the air.
But before you go, though, Thomas, I wanted to ask you a few more Vancouver questions. Because we never hear people talk about development in Vancouver. It must be happening. I've been to places
or
out there.
Displacement.
I've been out there trying to reach a location, and I feel like I'm driving through the countryside for hours. Mm-hmm. Vancouver just seems beautiful and fresh to me. But what do you see people being displaced in Vancouver?
Vancouver?
Yeah, I don't really have a handle on that myself. We do have some of those apartment buildings, which to me is just it's the big sore thumb sticking out in Portland. Every place I go in Portland, you know, around New Seasons, over on Interstate and things like that, all of those apartment buildings, there's a little bit of that. I assume that because we're embedded in the same system here, that those kinds of things are happening. You know, I mean, I think we're trying to become another San Francisco here. And I was just checking the rents out in San Francisco. I mean, a one-bedroom apartment, $3,000. You know, it's just outrageous. So I don't think there's a wall between Portland and Vancouver. You know, the system is the same here. It's just that, you know, it's slowed down. But we do get a pour over, right? People are going to escape from Portland and come to Vancouver. So we cannot stay immune from this.
Right. All right, Thomas, thanks a lot for calling. Something that he said that I've been thinking about a lot, it keeps coming back to me, and Karen Gibson, and her, she's an academic from Portland State University, and her really important essay called Bleeding Albina. People really need, if you care about this issue, you should read that essay, Bleeding Albina. It was published, I believe, in the Oregon Historical Society Quarterly, and they make
and
that.
And in 2007.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And they make that available for free, even though normally they don't necessarily make all their stuff available because they feel so strongly about it. But there's a sense that gentrification just happens organically, like, mm-hmm. like, oh, it's just what happens, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And you'll read that in the reader comments in the Oregon Live all the time, as if it were a natural process, but it's not.
No.
It is literally a corruption of systems. And that is kind of what Thomas is asking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little?
Definitely. I think the serial forced displacement, you know, just to put a little bit of a historical context around this, especially for African-American low-income communities in Portland, you know, Memorial Coliseum was a historical black neighborhood. I mean, let's not even talk about where black people lived with regard to downtown, right? You know, we were railroad workers and, you know, worked in hotels and things downtown. So folks actually lived, you know, the Golden West Hotel is down there. You know, there is a rich history of black people actually resident in the city, holding a lot of property there. I'm actually doing a mapping project currently that tracks black land ownership from 1900 to 1970. And it's fascinating to see what is the Pearl now actually had a lot of business and home ownership for black people there. So we have Memorial Coliseum. We have the Minnesota I-5 freeway, you know, that cut through neighborhood. They, you know, all of these projects took down hundreds and hundreds of homes that were occupied, single family homes. Then we have Legacy Emmanuel. I think, you know, they say they took about 100 homes for the expansion that never was. And then, you know, this last iteration is the urban renewal area that actually encompassed all 10 of the highest African-American concentrated neighborhoods, specifically in the Alberta Albina area in 2000, and then started this kind of hyper development. It was seeded, you know, with a bit of public money, had CDBG, community development block grant money. And Dr. Gibson's work is pivotal. I was lucky enough to have her as a professor when I was at Portland State, and she really broke the story, you know, really talking about the systemic issue, the chronic disinvestment, the decision to blight the area by the PDC, Portland Development Commission, you know, to intentionally redline it, which means banks won't lend there, but also the city was not investing money in this area. So if you do that over, you know, decades, the area is obviously going to degrade.
Let's dig into that really quickly right now. This is a kind of how that happened. So you are a homeowner and you need to re-roof your house. You really only need a couple thousand dollars to do that, right? Mm-hmm. But the bank won't loan you the money to do it.
Yes.
Right. So people end up getting loans that are terrible, terrible loans that just so that they can keep the water from damaging their
right.
home. But then, and a lot of these people that with what's happening now, many of these people are elderly now. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Willamette Week did a story about gentrification with an African-American family earlier this year. And I was critical of that story. But it literally, that's how this African-American family was on the verge of losing their home, too.
Right.
So it's like you're trying to do something simple that everybody does, right? You think, and you go to the bank and you're treated completely differently than everybody else
right.
is. And that's kind of what we're talking about.
Definitely.
You know, laws against that, laws against redlining. And Kat, you had mentioned reverse redlining. What's
right.
that?
Well, it uses the same map. So the Homeownership Loan Corporation, the Hulk map in 1938, outlined neighborhoods where banks would not lend. Basically, it's, you know, the area is made red. And so for here in Portland, there's a story in the Oregonian called Blueprint for a Slum. And that said, we had redlining in Portland until 1999.
That was a really super duper important article.
Everybody
it was also
read it.
Seminal. Tom Hallman was one of those reporters.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even win a Pulitzer for that, but it was a game changer.
It's a game changer, especially because in 1976, laws were put in place to make this practice illegal. So what happened with the housing crisis is those very same areas that had, you know, been disinvested and had no access to capital, exactly as you're saying, you know, it was easier for African Americans to get a car loan than to get a housing loan because of different requirements on, you know, the amount of the
That's
loan.
That's part of the system of rip-off, though, that people don't talk about very often is the rip-off of car loans of African American people. But keep going.
Yes. No, that's a whole nother show. So the reverse redlining was banks and lending institutions looking at those same maps and saying, you know, we know these people are very hungry for our products, for mortgages, for, you know, basically for mortgages, home repair loans, all of these things. And then they decided to start giving money in these areas, but gave substandard products, predatory loans, right? As one of the callers mentioned, adjustable rate mortgages. So, you know,
balloon payments.
Exactly. So after a couple of years with those adjustable mortgages, the payment suddenly balloons to an amount that is outside of the reach of the people. And people are not told on the front end.
My friend had, she bought a house on Northeast Garfield, and at a certain date, she had to pay $35,000.
Yes.
Like, what about $35,000? And she said to herself, no, I know it's coming, so I'll be able to save for it.
You can't
and
save.
She squeaked it by because in the end, she basically, this is before GoFundMe, she literally borrowed $300 from dozens of people.
Nice.
It was crazy. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah, so that's wonderful that she was able to do that.
She's the only person I know who's ever done that. But anyway.
Mindy Fullilove also talks about equity stripping. And so that's one of the things that's also very important about this. You know, people who had not been able to access home ownership were able to do so for a certain amount of time. And so, you know, just like everyone, they pay into these mortgages, assuming at some point they will be able to sell and have the money if they want, or pass this inheritance onto their children, who would then be able, you know, to live without a mortgage.
It's called building wealth.
It's a very novel concept. And then with the housing crisis, and banks really knew this was going to happen, they were prepared to take all of these properties back. It's essentially like, you know, a lease instead of being able to own your property. And so all the money people had paid in, hundreds of thousands of dollars toward their mortgages and the final payments, was all taken through foreclosures, right? They were not made whole through these. Some people were able to refinance. You know, there were some things that were put into place in 2009 to really try to stabilize. But what we can see is that those were not effective and that the size of the crisis was so significant. So many of these properties, to speak to what we were talking about earlier, were then held by the bank. So it is very easy for someone who's got money from somewhere else to say, oh my goodness, these houses I can buy for $70,000 and I could sell it for $300,000. I can buy up to 10 according to the law, and I can flip them and sell them immediately. They don't have to be owner occupied. You know, they don't have to be rented out. There are very few regulations about that. So people are getting very, very wealthy off of this. And what happens? People who've lived there lose their equity. Most of them are left with a lot of debt through the foreclosure crisis. We had a very dodgy foreclosure process where, you know, didn't even have to go have an
administrative process. That whole thing in Oregon actually, yeah, was all caught up in the courts and ledge and all that stuff like that.
Yeah,
so that was sketchy in itself. No offense. Sketchy.
So I wanted to speak, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he wanted to know if anything is working. Like, are there any examples of things that are working? And, you know, I think everybody's just really trying to get their arms around this. But cooperative ownership is one way communities have really been able to take back the power in their communities and to start building equity, as well as develop housing structures or economic development businesses that can incubate any kind of small business that, you know, will serve the community. The hard part is, how do you get the capital on the front end if you're low-income people? So then there are other examples like real estate investment trusts. There are, you know, some models that I've actually been working with some people to look at. We have a pilot project for, it's called a REIT, the Real Estate Investment Trust, through Mercy Corps out in the Lintz neighborhood. We're hoping to see if that's something that can become replicable. Living Cully is a really good example in
Living
Portland.
Living Cully is awesome.
Of a group of people place-bound in a neighborhood who've been able to really capitalize on the culture there and their place and say, we need to be the ones who determine what gets to come into this area and make sure that it is benefiting the community, right? So like community benefits agreements, theoretically, these are legally binding documents between community and developers or the government that do make explicit what people need. So, you know, making sure the investment is not just in the environment, built environment, but in the people who are living there so that, you know, they can build wealth and have choice of where they want to live.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. I am Lisa. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm sitting in for Ani and Lynn. And today we are live in the studio with community advocate Kat Gogenauer, founder of Radix Consulting Group. She does advocacy with the Urban League of Portland and Self-Enhancement Incorporated, a whole lot of community grassroots organizations. She helped with PALF's People's Plan and has a very deep knowledge of policy. And listeners, we do have a few minutes left of this show. We just started talking, is gentrification a public health issue? I think that's a fascinating way of looking at it. Is gentrification literally making you sick? So we want to hear your story. 503-231-8187. And Kat, I did want to ask you about the People's Plan and what's in the People's Plan. And the other piece of what we're talking about housing, but in a lot of ways on this level, what we're talking about with the gentrification, it also reflects on businesses, like people that want to start a small business. All these people with food carts really want a storefront. You know what I'm saying? So we're talking about housing, but the small businesses is part of that too.
Right.
But what was in the People's Plan? What was it? What is it?
The People's Plan is a community-driven visioning document that also will have policy recommendations coming out of it. I also had the opportunity to work on the Metro Equity Framework Report. Equity for me is the way to approach these things, as well as public health, right? We're talking about the people most impacted and bringing their voices to the fore, right? And so the People's Plan is a wonderful example of this. There are focus groups and community fora happening where, you know, instead of just dragging people out and saying, oh, what's the problem? How are you hurting? It's really saying, what would this look like if this city was built for Black people? What would your neighborhood look like? You know, and this is a model that's been used in other places. In New Orleans, they've created People's Plan. You know, I think so much of the research and data we have is driven by government. You know, so for instance, the Metro Framework Report, which I will say, for the six community-based organizations who participated in writing that, we were able to use a public health approach, speaking to the woman who spoke about restorative justice. We also said, you know, this is not just about a moral imperative. This is about justice. It's about equal distribution of resources and really addressing the gap. So we were able to do that. And then talking about the intersectional nature of all of these indicators, economic concerns, housing concerns, because what they talk about is housing cost burden. They talk about these things as burdens, right? So HUD says basically you shouldn't pay more than 30% of your income on housing and utilities every month, or you essentially we'll have a lot of trouble saving money or dealing with any kind of crisis that might arise. And then when we add transportation into that, especially for people who are out in the numbers, who have to come in, you know, to bring their kids to schools, you know, or come to their jobs, those required expenditures become untenable for people who are not earning enough. The other thing I just want to flag up is the Multnomah County Health Disparity Report. I mean, I can talk about reports all day, the Coalition for Communities of Color report, but the Multnomah County report was very much in line with the way I also approach this and the way many of, you know, my colleagues and contemporaries approach this. You know, class, low income status is one of the biggest determinants in a capitalist system as to whether or not you will have the resources at hand to care for yourself and to thrive. And so that is something that is not new. But what they found was that racism, and this is in their disparities report, and for me it's groundbreaking, is more significant than class in Multnomah County. So when we talk about those two things being folded together, we're talking about almost total exclusion from economic opportunities. You know, if I want a food cart or a storefront, that's one thing. But if I'm a highly educated person who is trying to get a job, and I'm facing discrimination in hiring, that's the other end of the spectrum, right? So we have this continuum of exclusion, and we can see how that's playing out in people's lives with cancer rates, asthma. You know, that's why for me this is a health crisis. So many of these things are caused by the systems we are forced to live in, and are it's just a very difficult thing to kind of change the course of the river, you know. But
because that's there's so many pieces of the puzzle in a
so
way.
So many factors.
In
but
a way.
Some of these, so we're doing a comprehensive plan update. It's the guiding document for the city of Portland. It lasts for 20 years. We're currently working under one that was created in 1980. So, you know, it's time to update that. These kind of things, we have opportunity really to get anti-gentrification, anti-displacement policies and language in there. You know, talking about solutions, I definitely commend the people who have spoken and said they go down to City Hall. You know, the thing I love about Portland, it's really small. So you can actually get in front of the people who are making decisions, and you can, you know, hopefully compel them to do different things.
May not be the case in San Francisco if you lived there.
Right. It's, you know, the system there is much larger. And then the other thing, I was reading in a report recently, and it said, you know, even after the recession, middle-income jobs are not returning to Portland. We've got service sector, very low-income jobs. And, you know, I'm not disparaging anyone. I was a waitress for 12 years as my primary source of income before I went to university. So, and, you know, it's a very hard life. But then we have these very, very, very high-income jobs also coming in. You know, we headquarter so many national corporations, multinational corporations. And yet, you know, we have such high poverty rates, child poverty rates, low graduation rates, some of the worst in the nation. Even, you know, the comparator, everybody likes to say, even worse than the South, you know. Yes, in the North, we also have inequality. So you talk about these things and then how those impact people's ability to access. So, you know, I think with the People's Plan, the State of Black Oregon, you know, all of these community of color reports, they have so many recommendations in them. You know, I think putting out that vision is very important. And then the next step for all of us is, you know, holding folks accountable, figuring out how to do some enforcement. And I know we're getting to kind of more of wanting to focus on solutions. So one part that's very important, I did work at the Fair Housing Council for some time, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968 is an amazing lever. And they have this part of it called the duty to affirmatively further fair housing. And rather than saying, you know, don't discriminate, you can't concentrate poverty, be nice to people, this really says that you have to expand that jurisdictions, municipalities, states, everyone who receives federal money has to conduct programs in such a manner that they affirmatively further fair housing. That talks about actions that expand mobility for households in opportunity-rich communities. That's the funny thing also about gentrification specifically. If you looked at North Portland maps in 2000, it's one of the lowest opportunity areas. In 2013, Portland Housing Bureau brought out their opportunity maps. And now, 13 years later, it has some of the highest opportunity in terms of connectivity with transportation, access to jobs, all of these things. And at the very same time, the people who were forced to live for decades in deprivation can't take advantage of that. So we also have to reduce segregation and work to not concentrate poverty. So pushing people out still concentrates poverty in a new geography.
And where do you go after Gresham? We're all, you know what? We're all going to move up to the top of Mount Hood because global warming will have warmed up. All the glaciers will be gone. So we could just go up there in tiny houses. Tiny houses on the top of, damn it, Mount Hood. I said it. All right. This is positively revolting. I can see the magical engineering pixie is on the phone. We have a few callers. Let's see if we can line some of the callers up here. BJ's on the phone. What's going on, man?
Hi. I got to turn the radio down. Gentrification is for big cities with a lot of money. And what they're trying to do is push through because cheap land here and the big construction companies. And they're doing it because they have the money. What do you have? What power do you and I have? Anything? Do we have anything? I don't have any power.
We've got torches and pitchforks and rotten tomatoes and the vote.
Well, you could burn the buildings down. That's about the only thing.
That's
what they
too
did
much
in
work.
LA.
Anyway, awesome, BJ. Thanks a lot for calling. Sometimes the big reality is hard to take, but maybe it'll light a fire underneath our rear ends. Do we have another caller?
I just wanted to say, to me, we have moral authority, you know, as people. In 1999, when the WTO protests happened, there were some very interesting articles that were written talking about the second superpower is coming. And what they were really speaking about, what was being reported on, was, you know, with increased access to media, people are able to organize across the world and really to start pushing. And we can also lift up things like, you know, what the gentleman spoke about is happening in Spain. Germany just capped all rents across the entire country. I mean, you know, there are some really progressive...
They did that?
They did.
Socialists. Isn't that where Marx came from?
Well, you know, that's
what do you say,
Marx's
birthday's in May.
We have to care about the people. And so I don't despair. I'm always asking, how do you make power out of no power? And also, to your point, I'm from the coast. I'm from Newport, Oregon. And so the thing is, you know, I know what's out in the rest of Oregon. And it's not a bad thing, but it's not connected in the same way.
That's interesting.
And gentrification is also happening in these small towns because these are destination spots. People have vacation rentals. And I'll tell you, homelessness is increasing in even those small areas.
We could talk about that a little bit. We also have James on the phone. James, are you there?
I am.
What's going on, man?
I wanted to comment on the last caller's bringing up the subject of what do we have versus the large, powerful sources that are
kind of is the question in a way. What do you think, James?
Well, I think the numbers are what we have, and mm-hmm. our numbers clearly outnumber those that we have hired and voted to elect into the positions of power. So it's really it's our responsibility to speak to these people who have the actual control. And explain to them, you know, we have 30 or 40 to 1 of us against each one of you. Now, if you don't start listening to us, then we're going to simply not be pleased with your performance.
Pitchforks and torches. Yep. Right on, James.
Hey, by the way, the gentrification thing, it's really critical that people are lightening up on Bruce Jenner because, you know, there's nothing wrong with gentrification, and he wanted to change his gender because he was once a really heck of a good guy, and he was a real man. And when he did the gentrification, is that gentrification?
No, but I'm good with it. I get the idea, James. Thanks a lot for calling, James.
Thank you, ma'am. And by the way, you girls are very, very smart.
You are too, hon.
I just wanted to speak quickly to what he said about the numbers. You know, the other thing is, people who are in public service have a duty to respond to the needs of their constituency. They have a duty to do no harm, and they have a duty of care. And so, you know, reminding people that is what we're doing. This is not, you know, us trying to do a power play. It's really, we live in a society, we pay taxes, we are part of a community, and therefore we also have a right to have our rights respected and to have fair allocation of resources.
Thank you. Somebody should have that tattooed on their forehead. It's our response. This is our country. You know what I'm saying? I sound like some, like, I don't know, that hippie folk guy that sang about the dam, whatever. Anyway, this is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Next week, Ani and Lynn are back. I know you've been waiting for them to come back. We have a few minutes left in this show, and the number's 503-231-8187. I can see that the magical engineering pixie is definitely hung up. She does a lot of stuff in that room. Listeners, did you know that this is live radio? Anyway, let's ask Kat, in the last minutes we have left, there's so much in the headlines about gentrification for people who care about it. What should we be paying attention to?
We should be paying attention to the impact it has on people. The World Health Organization and Center for Disease Control have both said that gentrification is a public health issue. It is driving so much sickness, just suffering, you know. And so I would say, let's change the way we are thinking and talking about this. It is about developers and bankers and government officials and all of these folks making decisions on our behalf. But also, we have a right to talk about how it feels for us and how it limits what we can do and be. You know, Portland, and everybody likes to talk about, it's where you work, live, play, and pray. These are words from the World Health Organization, and they are specifically in conjunction to gentrification. And so talking about, you know, your zip code is more important than your genetic code, we can't just move people to a new zip code and think they're going to thrive if those neighborhoods don't have sidewalks, if they are food deserts, you know, if they don't have transportation. So really looking at solutions, I would say pay attention to what the city is doing. We have an opportunity to write letters, to really go and show them that we care about this issue and that at this point in time, we have a unique opportunity to do it differently. There's one, you know, nerdy little bit. I just want to read, it's very short, but about the affirmatively furthering fair housing. This is a piece of fair housing legislation that is currently being lifted up. This summer, it will go into effect, and this will create a new requirement for governments. They will have to do annual reporting that they understand the issues in their community that they have. So let me see. They identify the determinants of thriving, that they address the conditions that are causing people to suffer, and that they set goals and actually do an action. They will have to do this reporting every year or their federal money becomes jeopardized. So the one thing is always said to me, well, what about the private market? You know, the federal government gives this money to city and public officials. That's a different thing. But this duty also falls to private money. As soon as that money is taken in by a state, municipality, or jurisdiction, it says the duty to affirmatively further fair housing extends to all housing and housing-related activities in the grantee's jurisdictional area, whether publicly or privately funded. And so this, for me, you know, being a nerd who loves policy, is definitely a way that we can start having a different conversation. We should look at the amount of suffering that is coming from this. We should do cost analyses of this. You know, Utah is doing wonderful things. They sat and said, how expensive is it for people to be homeless? Mm-hmm. And then they decided to provide houses because it's cheaper to put people in homes.
We have to leave it there. This is an amazing show. Kat Gogenauer, you should be a journalist. You should have a blog. You should be writing about this stuff. That's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Kat Gogenauer. This show will be podcast on KBOO.FM by the end of today. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. If you want some more information about some of these issues, go to pdxpeoplesplan.org. Keep your eye on the Urban League of Portland. And thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
Means and ends, deciding where to draw the line. Loss of work in Sellafield homes, or the threat of cancers yet to come. The choice seems obvious, there is no choice, only the option of looking outside. This narrow definition of what you see is all there will ever be.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Stay tuned for APA Focus.
There comes a time.